future psychiatrist, but right now I am working on general medical floors. I was telling some people I woke up at 5 a.m. today to round on patients to get out early so I could come do this, and then when I'm done with this, I'm running back there to discharge a bunch of patients. As an intern, the subject matter, all this high-minded stuff is about the furthest thing from my mind. As a matter of fact, I think thinking is probably the worst thing you can do as a general medicine intern. But, you know, as luck would have it, I ended up scheduling the talk at the busiest possible time on my service, and I'm really glad I could make it here, and thank you all for coming. I was a Penn undergrad from 2000 to 2004. I was a psychology major, and I barely missed getting my philosophy double major, but I was a minor. I went to the Bryn Mawr post-bac program immediately after graduating, and I went straight from there to Jefferson Medical College, where I spent 4 miserable years. And then I did the best thing I have ever done, and I botched the match process so I could come to the Penn Center of Bioethics for a year and just hang out. I don't think you ever saw me in dress clothes once. I actually have forgotten that how to tie a tie in the last year, but I had to reteach myself. And I'm really happy to be back and to be doing this talk. This is a topic that I've been interested in since I was an undergrad, and I'd love to hear about all of you now.
So maybe we can go around the room, say who we are.
Just the light down, just
sure. Yeah. Michael?
Okay. I'm Michael Young. I'm an intern here over the summer working with the Scattergood Ethics Program at Kiowa and with Scott Halpern.
Bernard Staley, Professor of English at Communion College, specializing in critical thinking.
Lynn Morrison, I'm a pediatric intensivist and palliative care doc over at CHOP, as well as a graduate of the MBA program and a poet.
Can I tell you a funny story about that, by the way?
Yes.
at 9 p.m. yesterday, I wrote my first hospice orders.
Ah,
a hospice nurse came over and gave me this complicated list of if IV comes out, do not replete, please morphine, Q1, 20 minutes, and so like, and she said, oh my God, I'm so thankful that you just wrote them and didn't go, why are we doing this? Why are we doing this? So I said, oh, I have a master's in bioethics.
Yeah, you had a little background.
Yeah.
Kathleen Hentgens, an interested lay person, but I was a hospice volunteer for years, so that kind of especially answers me.
Thanks for coming.
I'm Steve Petro. I am working, I'm an intern here this summer with the with Autumn's project for LGBTQ
okay.
bioethics.
Cool.
Brian Hastein, I'm an intern this summer with one of the deans in the law school, Ada Allen, who specializes in privacy. Penn undergrad in history and sociology of science, Temple Law School, 10 years as a litigation attorney, which has been on the happiest work years of my life. and I leave for Manchester, England in about a month to attend their bioethics and law program.
Great.
I'm Jim McCartney. I'm the director of the PhD program at Villanova in philosophy and teach bioethics and the law at the law school and undergraduate philosophy of law and ethics for healthcare professionals. And a fellow here at the center.
I'm Katie Murphy. Dr. McCartney's intern for the summer.
I'm Amy Gould. I'm a religion major at Colgate University, and I just applied to med school. And I was an intern with Dr. Kirkpatrick, working on guilt and cardiovascular medicine.
Great.
All right, and my name is Michelle, and I just graduated from UC Berkeley with a degree in environmental biology, and I'm interested in pursuing medicine or nursing, I'm not sure yet.
Okay.
And I'm interning with Dr. Perlman, looking at public health ethics this summer.
You said environmental biology?
Environmental biology.
Oh.
I'm Jenna Mullett. I'm a philosophy major at Emory, and I'm also working with David.
Hi, I'm David Perlman. I'm an associate here at the center. Senior lecturer over at the School of Nursing. And yes, these are 1/2 of the dream team. I had the pleasure of having 3 excellent interns These guys are working on a public health ethics project, and Ryan, who's actually leaving tomorrow, I'm kind of bummed. He actually did, he and I worked on a series of 16 podcasts. Basically, it's an introduction to clinical ethics. It can be freely available on YouTube and iTunes University.
Hi, Nora Jones. I'm the Associate Director of Graduate Studies here for our Master of Bioethics program.
Hila? I'm Hila Rumon-Binsman, the Coordinator for the Scattergood Ethics Program on Mental Health Ethics.
Hi, I'm Tia Chen. I'm a lab tech at Spock Chase Cancer Center. This is my first exposure to bioethics.
Must be the right. Are you in the science
well,
center?
Well, I came to
the
lecture
Okay. You're in the right
all
place.
Time. You should
well,
go
I'm
all the way
research
down.
Side and not the clinical side.
And she's my only Facebook friend out of 650 who I invited who showed up.
Oh, my boss is
oh, wait,
on vacation.
But I have
there
one
you go.
I have like a children for the next couple hours, so I should get away.
And we lost our speakers.
Yeah, while he's leading his guests through the building.
All right, so the main points of this talk. What is the relevance of both classical and modern philosophy to the practice of 21st century medicine? I will not answer this question during this talk. It is far too broad, but spectrum, we're gonna be there. What is the ideological basis for humanism in medicine? I also will probably not be able to answer that question fully, but I like ancient Greek philosophy and existentialism as a good background for why we do the things we do here right now, you know, in bioethics, medical anthropology, and related fields. And this is my controversial point. If I was giving a talk to all MDs, I'm sure I'd get some grumbles. Why is existentialism and humanism more important than professionalism to the sound practice of medicine? And this is something I stole from Judah Goldberg, so it's not original, but I'll get to that. That's one of my favorite topics in this talk. So, you know what? Eudaimonia, the big catchy word that probably got my essay published because it's pretentious and is something that no doctor I've spoken to, and I've spoken to many, have heard of before, except one psychiatrist. It's the ancient Greek word for human flourishing, and basically as a term it differs from our 21st century perspective, which is more of a checklist idea of what makes a person flourishing. In medicine, we do all kinds of quantitative ways to see how well they're doing. In psychiatry, we have the GAF. God, I'm trying to think of what else. I mean, like, there's so many ways that we try to quantify. I mean, pain scales, lots of stuff. But it's extremely objective, and it's not necessarily holistic. The Greek definition of human flourishing was holistic, and it was the entire quality of a person's life, not just any one aspect. So something like bad health could be consistent with a life led with eudaimonia. I mean, Socrates, I think, had, I mean, somebody, I think, gout, or, I mean, he had some issues. And we would still say that he led his life with, he flourished. That's a tricky thing to get doctors to understand. We like to think in terms of problems, a problem list. There is a lot of negative qualifiers for health, but there are not a whole lot of positive qualifiers. We don't have a lot of terms to say what's right about a patient, or what's good about them, or what's smart about their life decisions. You know, we just have non-compliant, not taking their meds. So what does human flourishing have to do with healthcare? I'm sure anybody who's worked in palliative care can, hi Zach. I'm sure anyone who's worked with dying patients can give some applications. Can we quantify human flourishing? I just want to put that to the group. I don't know. Anybody have any ideas? Sure.
Well, I know there have been some attempts in terms of measuring utility, which is a related concept, in like Bayesian statistics and things like that.
How about a patient who's in a hospital?
Yeah, it's I mean, I don't know, because I haven't gone into the field much, so I don't know.
Well, how good is philosophy if it can't be applied? Anyway.
Well, it's immediately culturally bound.
It's very
flourishing at all. It's more very culture somewhat.
Sure.
You know,
oh, absolutely.
What kind of pain one should accept and not accept, et cetera, things like that. Mm-hmm. So it's automatically right in the danger area of problematics.
And there's the issue of expressing the pain. Certain cultures,
oh, yeah,
you cry. In certain cultures, you shut up and you just
parrot. I spent my entire morning talking to a lady who went into seizures from benzo withdrawal, from Ativan or Valium withdrawal, who just didn't, big, huge family, and the family went crazy when she had her seizures. Grandma's dying, and the last person you'd ever expect to be a, not a drug seeker, but, you know, I guess you could say a drug abuser. She said, well, I had no idea that they were dangerous pills. I didn't. And I spent about 15 minutes saying, well, look, we're tapering you off this stuff. You're going to be withdrawing, and you need to tell your family, tell your doctors how you are feeling. And this is a American-born Irish Philly lady who just shut her mouth, never said anything about her feelings. And she was certainly not flourishing, but I don't think the family knew that. And that's a huge dilemma, and that's a big part of my interest, which is the interface between mental health care and physical.
It's a perfect example of
thank
the culture,
yeah.
Now, isn't it? I mean, that is what vignette.
Okay.
There have been attempts to quantify quality of life, mm-hmm. or as they call them, qualities. Seem to be, you know, flourishing themselves a few years ago, but not
right.
so much today.
Right. You know, I've never seen them. I've never filled out anything that had me assess something globally about the patient. You know, it's, we write soap notes every day. That's subjective, objective assessment and plan. The subjective line on the average patient note is patient without complaints, no vomiting, no diarrhea, or whatever. You know, it's no one ever says, you know, the patient talked to me about this. The patient, it's really try to take that subjective element and squeeze it into as small a box as possible, I think.
What I always say is you can make quality of life judgments about yourself. You can't really make them about anyone else because you don't live in their lives.
Wait, we have to get to existentialism first.
I think there is a recognition more in psychology than medicine that mm-hmm. maybe there's going to be some benefit to studying people who are thriving, you know, like people who are handling life well, or
great.
Couples who are doing well. I think that there's people that are starting to recognize and publish about that, like, hey, why don't we look
yeah.
at people that are successes and see how they do it, and may learn just as much as we do by looking at people that are having problems.
I have a funny anecdote about that too, because I'm psychology, wonderful, psychiatry. When I was on my third year psych rotation at Jefferson, they told me that I couldn't give a GAF score above 80. Now that means global assessment of function. A person with a GAF of 80 is somebody who's flourishing. And the insinuation there, when they said you can't give it, the attending has to evaluate that to give a score that high, was that as a 24-year-old, 25-year-old med student suffering whatever I was doing, I don't know how to see someone who's doing well. And I thought that was one of the most condescending things I've ever heard. Okay, let me move on a little bit. So eudaimonia, I think it's a very valuable idea to talk about, to think about, but it is very hard to assess and to apply, especially in another human being, let alone yourself. I mean, sorry, yourself, let alone another human being. Like I said before, it's much easier to tell when a person isn't flourishing, and more often than not, they will tell you, although, of course, there's a lot of variability. It's a kind of uncomfortable and non-socially acceptable thing to do to talk about suffering. In most parts of the country, I assume most parts of the world too. So this is an idea I got from a psychoanalyst named Alan Wheelis, who died recently. The idea is that some people have elected suffering, whereas some people undergo imposed suffering. And his quote was, I'm just going to paraphrase, it was something like, The pain and sorrow of doubt and dread and all these existential things goes away under the threat of SS truncheons. So when you have an imposed threat, it's pretty hard to feel depressed that, well, you know, you're not as you're balder than you used to be or something like that. Not a great example, but
I know.
I'm sorry. Well, I'll get there. Don't worry. So an important point here is that, and we see this time and time again, just as an intern, I've dealt with this, where we are managing a patient's needs as far as we see them, all the quantifiable needs are met, and the person is still not happy. And you get the sense that there's a real interpersonal element that, cultural bound or not, I think that, you know, humans are a social race, and it's very difficult for a person to be an island and to be flourishing on their own. Flourishing, I think, is something that needs to happen in a social context, in a community. And very often, it's the family's needs who aren't met when we're dealing with patients who maybe do seem satisfied with their care. And that's something that's very difficult to deal with. And again, it's unfortunately the kind of thing that's dealt with more often when somebody gets angry and something goes wrong. So I asked this question already, why is human flourishing so elusive? Is it really clinically applicable? I think we discussed that pretty well. So Plato's Allegory of the Cave, this is not from the original essay. It's not from the original essay, but I had a stroke of maybe genius, maybe stupidity, but I decided that I put an analogy in here. So the gist of it is, raise your hand here if you're not familiar with Plato's Allegory of the Cave. Okay, sure. So basically the idea is, and you've heard, this has been, I mean, the Matrix in and of itself is Plato's Allegory of the Cave. I mean, this is an idea that's been so, I would say, you know, it's such a part of Western thought that we don't even think about it anymore. And basically the idea is, most of what we see is artificially contrived forms. Our leaders are projecting shadows in front of a screen, and most of us are just brainwashed watching this fake stuff. It takes a real strong act of consciousness to turn around and say, wait a second, I think that something's wrong here. Climb out of the cave, see the light of the true forms. Plato was big into ideals. We'll talk more about that later. But the idea then is that people who have gone and seen the light, or maybe studied philosophy, who go to tell their friends what they've learned, and oh my God, this is so amazing, and Zach is always talking to me about Foucault and stuff like that. It's not that amazing to people who haven't read philosophy. It's just they don't get it. And I really like Plato's Allegory of the Cave as a good analogy for the problem of humanists in medicine. Because you might think you've seen the light, I certainly think I have to some extent, but you are faced with a lot of resistance by people who are pretty set in their ways and don't want to turn around and look and see the big picture. It's a really important question is philosophy essential to everyone, or is it a semantic exercise? You know, I mean, I want to keep publishing in humanities journals, but will that accomplish anything? Can we change the way that people practice medicine in a place like this? Sure.
No, just before you go on from Plato, just something else to think about.
Because
you and I have talked about this before,
yeah.
As a philosopher versus a relativistic anthropologist.
Philosophy hobbyist.
I use Plato's Allegory of the Cave in a sort of a different way. I say,
okay.
On some level, I don't care what's going on behind me, because
okay.
I'm dealing with people, and I care about what the people themselves understand.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's my big split with the philosophers who want me to turn around. I'm like, pshh. People aren't acting on what's behind them, they're acting on what's in front of them.
So that's the reason I used it as a little bit of an analogy and not
mm-hmm.
a literal thing, because I don't like Plato. I mean, Plato's a genius, I'm sorry. I don't mean I don't like Plato, I just mean that, you know what, I'm gonna have to backtrack a little bit to explain what I meant by that. So the entire idea, I learned the word eudaimonia from an article by Martha Nussbaum from the late 70s, and she basically made a direct application, like doctors, human flourishing, use it. And I read this article and I said, what, really take this abstract idea and just put it in doctors' heads and they'll just go out there and start making people happier just with just go flourish. It doesn't make any sense. So the existentialism element, I think, brings a lot of the same stuff to the table as what you're talking about, where, cultural difference, interpersonal difference, like there's so many factors preventing any, let's say one person has the ideal form, let's say that Plato or Socrates really knew the true meaning of justice. Well, unfortunately it died with him because he wasn't able to, you know, convey it literally. It's that level of separation. I'm going to get to that later. Because when, even as an undergrad, just having read a little bit of Kierkegaard, I said, no, I don't think Nussbaum has it right. And she's a good philosopher, and she really does good work on medical ethics, but it just seemed too literal for my taste. And that's really the genesis of this whole article. I think that ancient Greek philosophy, for all its benefits, and I mean it is the root of a lot of Western thought, it just is, I think, too far removed to be applicable to medicine at this point. And I think that, as I'll go on, I think existentialism provides a nice bridge. Yeah, go on.
Take the notion even further. I actually, I haven't written a paper on this, but I've definitely given it some thought, that philosophy can actually be very harmful to people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had a student one time, I was talking about existentialism in my intro bioethics course, and he had suicidal ideation.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, you know, I was really interested. Can you give me some existential readings?
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, whoa, would you not need to be giving someone who has suicidal ideation?
No, you really don't.
So it's just going to push him over the edge.
Wow.
So I did the appropriate thing and basically said, I have to deal with this person as it is. I'm going to make a referral to CAPS, our counseling center. So rather than letting him see the forms, I was like, no, you're not ready for the forms yet.
I agree, but just as a quick rebuttal, like, what about Judas Priest and those kids who blew their brains out? You know, it's like, are you going to blame Sartre for, like, somebody's misinterpretation?
Sartre's pretty heavy.
It's really depressing.
Yeah.
I know. I know, but I'm just saying.
Yeah.
Hilla, you had a question or comment?
No.
No? Okay. Let me move on then. How can we translate philosophy to medical practice? So this, the goals of medicine, there was, I forget when this was, in the mid-90s, a group of physicians and policymakers met in Prague, I believe it was Prague, and they came up with these four goals: the prevention of disease and injury and the promotion of and maintenance of health, the relief of pain and suffering caused by maladies, care and the cure of those with a malady and the care of those who cannot be cured, and the fourth goal is the avoidance of premature death and the pursuit of a peaceful death. Now, I said okay, but I'm not exactly sure where I was going to go with that, but I guess the point is really easier said than done. And if you run, you know, I wonder if you took a group of doctors and asked them to come up with what the goals are, if they'd come up with anything this well-rounded and humanistic seeming. I know for a fact that the pursuit of a peaceful death is one of the hardest things to get in a hospital setting. The care of those who cannot be cured is probably disastrous. I mean, I would, chronic illness, substance dependency, mental illness, and most patients have all these, you know, or a good percentage do, and their care is compromised. It is extremely compromised. And so you have things like, don't go into room one, the guy's just a drug seeker, he's going to ask you for opiates. Well, maybe he's really in pain. She's not really suicidal, she's just looking for a place to crash. I hear that one all the time. I don't know about you guys, but if I wanted to sleep somewhere, I wouldn't go to a hospital. And, you know, if your life is bad enough that you do need to go to a hospital to sleep, then you probably deserve to be treated for whatever. I mean, there's something there. Also, I don't want to give the impression that there is a good guys versus bad guys thing going on. I am an anti-doctor doctor. I went to med school with this idea that I'm never going to conform or something, but 95% of the doctors I've met are lovely, lovely, caring people, and we all do and say the same, not, well, to some degree, to varying degrees, the same sort of, I'm going to say disrespectful, but dismissive things about patients with difficult personalities, challenging needs, diffuse complaints, pain from a source that we can't localize. It's tough. So I wrote here, good interpersonal conduct in almost impossible situations. You can have a wonderful doctor, you can have patients who are compliant and caring, you know, and concerned about their health. Well, I once had to see, as a first-year med student, just rounding in a neurology ward, I saw a 37-year-old mother of two get diagnosed with brain cancer, and it was horrifying. And that happens. It glioblastoma, the worst kind of brain cancer, doesn't, it tends to attack middle-aged people, not old people. So there's a real dose of, there's a real dose of tragedy just there, just present, regardless of how well you handle things. And so there's a place for philosophy, I think, in those gray areas where medicine really can't do anymore. I went through a lot of this before. Bioethics, a cog in the machine of medicine. That's just put that up there.
Back just for a second.
Yeah, sure.
Goals. You know, goals are that. They're things to achieve, but there's always the tragic to human life.
Mm-hmm.
You always have to measure the reality of the tragic against the goal.
Sure.
And goals as goals, the ones that were there are pretty good. And I've
yeah.
seen in many different,
yeah.
seen those four come up with
mm-hmm.
many different groups, so both medical and philosophical groups. So,
mm-hmm.
I would say you always have to temper your idea of goals with the reality of the world. You were talking about existentialism, the
yeah.
first tragedy
yeah.
of life, and goals always can be accomplished.
That's true. I'm just going to, so let me go back. So the famous Michelangelo depiction of Aristotle and Plato, I'm just going to show you that picture because I'm going to just briefly discuss the whole objectivity versus subjectivity, empiricism versus subjectivity sort of divide. So you see Aristotle pointing to the ground, no, it's here, we can find it on Earth, and Plato going, no, it's up there, we have to, you know, ask the gods what they think, or... I'm sorry, I'm just paraphrasing. I'm sure they, first of all, they're talking in Greek, but. Okay.
It was all Greek to them.
Yeah, that's right. But so this is a question that I haven't spent that much time thinking of yet, but I'm sure I will spend a lot of time thinking about in the future, especially with psychiatry sort of running the midline between objective and subjective. Do these things really need to be in opposition? When we divide out a patient's pain and their complaints from the findings from a CT scan or from the lab values, there's not really any synthesis. Well, I mean, you hope to pinpoint, it's almost like pin the tail on the donkey. Like, the patient is manifesting this complaint, so the lab values look like this. This equals that, pin the tail. If the lab values and the studies don't show what the patient is complaining of manifesting, the whole subjective component will get ignored. I guarantee you that if the patient is in a normal hospital setting, maybe not so much in a primary care clinic, certainly not in hospice care, but we have a real problem, I've seen just in my last 2 weeks as an intern, 3 weeks, we have a real problem when the subjective component and the objective component don't match up. And I would just throw it out to the group if anybody has any thoughts on it.
If the patient's perceptions and their expression of it, which could be two things, they feel
mm-hmm.
a certain way and then they try to explain to you, if that's inconsistent with empirical data, it doesn't mean they're crazy. It could mean that there's something that medicine hasn't found yet.
Oh,
because that particular person is having a pain in their ankle, and you haven't realized yet that a tumor in a certain part of the brain is going to send a signal to the brain that says your ankle hurts, when in fact there's nothing wrong with your ankle. And we do know there are those links, but
let me just change that around a little bit, because you're describing something that maybe we don't see, but it's there. How about things like fibromyalgia, neuropathic pain? These are things that are, they're there. They are physiologic, but they're also sort of ephemeral. So fibromyalgia is diffuse pain in various areas of the body. It's a totally subjective assessment. Some doctors don't think it's a real disorder. I think it might be characterized as a cultural bound syndrome. I'm not sure.
And with women, they often.
Well, I mean, it's certainly, I mean, hysteria in the 19th century also, you could call that a cultural bound syndrome. But my point is that there could very easily be a biochemical, physiologic basis for it, and we just haven't discovered it yet. But that doesn't stop at least 40% of doctors from saying this is bullshit. So it's a problem.
And that's when people turn to complementary medicine, try to get answers.
I think that it's really important that MDs, DOs accept complementary medicine as just that, and maybe even, you know, it's more than complementary, because medicine is turning into specialty care, and complementary medicine is actually more holistic. You probably get a more thorough evaluation from somebody who's doing acupuncture on you than from your primary care doctor. I don't know. I don't see either.
Complementary is an alternative medicine, sounds like, you know.
Yeah.
It's a totally different thing. This says, you know, most medicine's good, but bringing other approaches.
I like alternative because it sounds cool.
Yeah.
Extreme alternative.
Extreme medicine. Okay.
Do you think chronic fatigue syndrome is like...
Oh, absolutely. I actually in the follow-up essay, you know what, maybe it's even in this essay, I lumped that in there. Yes, I said chronic fatigue as well as fibromyalgia. And I mean, honestly, I think chronic fatigue is it's clearly associated with depression. Depression is a biological disorder. It manifests in physical ways, and it's interesting that some patients end up never seeing a psychiatrist because they are stuck in patterns of, or their doctors aren't culling the correct story out of them, and they're being treated for physical complaints when there's really something underlying, psychiatric. So yeah, that also applies.
Do you use at all Kleinman's distinction between curing and healing?
No, we should. No, I love Kleinman. I mean,
mm-hmm.
It's just...
Well, the idea that, you know, you heal or you cure disease, but you heal people.
We don't use any of those terms. Mm. I mean, I don't.
It just resonates with what you guys are doing.
It absolutely does, but I just mean in a medical setting,
mm-hmm.
I don't recall the last time I said we cured him or we healed him or anything like this. We just discharge people. Healing them is for the...
Can I borrow that line? We don't cure or heal, we just
right
discharge?
Right,
yeah, I'm going
that's
to.
Great.
I like it.
Yeah, I'm sleep deprived. That's where it comes
it's good.
From.
It's a good one.
Thank you. I really like this is again, we're moving towards existentialism, and I'm sure we've already touched upon a lot of those issues. But I like the term beyond the gold standard. I once sat through a horrible lecture on statistics where in med school it was about 45 minutes of, now the reason you do these things is they're evidence based. Someone did a meta-analysis, and these are the things that treat the patients. This is the gold standard treatment, so we're going to use this on all our patients. There's a real reductive approach in medicine, which is the best statistically for everyone is the best individually, and there's not a really good, let's say, doctors don't think well. They aren't trained to think critically about how an individual might deviate from the norm. And so we have all these parameters that are based on the typical patient, whereas I don't know the typical patient. And we have, I love this, the criteria for bipolar disorder, or like must have had a manic episode, not under the influence of substances for 6 months or something. And, well, a lot of people, I mean, gee, the vast majority of people I've met with bipolar are also have some comorbid substance use. So technically, if you use cocaine while you were manic, or maybe the cocaine made you manic, we can't diagnose bipolar. And I don't think we can really do anything about that per se, but it's a real problem to have guidelines that don't work, and we have a lot of them. That was just one example off the top of my head, but we have a lot of gold standard stuff that, if it holds up to the evidence-based treatment, I don't know if it applies clinically without the critical thinking that goes on in a place like the Penn Center of Bioethics. And I assure you, it does not go on the floors. The only thing that I mean, there's a lot of I would say, an arms race to get the latest meta-analysis, the latest clinical recommendations, but if we remember the breast cancer reversal from last year on the mammograms, it's, I don't really, I mean, I'm sure some of you guys know more about this than me, but it just, it seems to me just remarkable that you could have guidelines for everybody and then just change them on a dime. And I think we really need to talk more about what's wrong at a global level with gold standard medicine, with, let's put it this way, evidence-based medicine isn't evidence-based, in my opinion, because it, I'll just leave it at that.
Well, it depends on what you mean by evidence. I mean, if you have a very flowing kind of definition of evidence, then it's subject to change. It's like the scientific method. It's falsifiable.
In fact, that's the first thing you have to sort out, what's going to count as evidence.
That's what I'm talking, that's kind of, that's sort of what I was getting at, yeah. That's what I'm getting at, and the thing is that when we talk about, like, guidelines for, I don't know, like, coronary artery disease, things that affect huge proportions of the population, there's so many parameters to look at. It's really hard to say something is evidence-based given what's left in, what's left out. If the patients were white, black, where are they from, or the social status, all kinds of factors. It's almost impossible. It's very...
Cholesterol's a good example.
Yeah, it really
numbers.
Is.
One day I was healthy, and the next day I was
here you
not.
Go. That's right.
So,
that's right.
You must feel a lot better.
That's right.
Yeah. But
that's great.
The other extreme is just as bad, where the, you know, it's all biased, and it's all just what the doctor thinks is going to work.
Which is why psychiatry is now trying to streamline and become very rule-based and biological, but then again, it's lost some of that.
Into those rules, whatever he's been saying is exactly true. There has to be, they have to use as guidelines, not as strict approaches to what's needed.
Right, and that's all I'm saying. Beyond gold standard to me just means extra flexibility. Let me skip ahead. Existentialism, the answer to all of medicine's problems. I'm glad you guys laughed, because I don't think existentialism is the answer to any problems. If anything, it makes everyone's life more difficult. When I submitted this essay, I did not have a definition of existentialism. They told me, please define existentialism and then make the essay more clinical. Of course, they always ask for it to be more clinical. I think I stole it from Wikipedia. This one I came up with at 4 a.m. after call. So life is subjective. Every person suffers from dread and anguish caused by the fact that we are conscious of our limitations and our mortality. I consider Kierkegaard the godfather of existentialism. Some people don't consider him an existentialist. I don't care what you call him. He's absolutely a genius. I am absolutely a Kierkegaard fanboy. Life is not experienced rationally, it is experienced emotionally. There is an overemphasis on objectivity, and the importance of rationality has caused philosophy to go astray. And I noted, what about medicine today? That's a main takeaway point from here. We grow up learning that to be irrational is about as close to being evil as you can be. And I'm going to argue, and as Kierkegaard argued, that the belief that one is being rational is actually the cause of a lot of evil and a lot of problems. And I remember reading, I think it was Either Or, where Kierkegaard says, once you get this, throw this book down. Where it's like, whoa, that's not knowledge, that's telling me to do something. And I really like that's an example of existentialist knowledge, which is something that it's palpable. It's something that is not to be intellectualized. So in other words, you know, if I sat here talking about Sartre and Kierkegaard and Camus it's very hard to read these guys. They're difficult writers, but the take-home messages should be things that you already kind of know from your own life experiences. Existentialism isn't here to really teach you anything new, I would say. It's more effective at helping you reassess. Well, it's more effective at teaching you what you don't know and cannot possibly know. And it's certainly a good way to bring up doubt. And I think medicine needs a little more doubt. One thing I'll note here, the link, and this is more clearly the essay that you guys have is a little more clear on this, but so Kierkegaard's favorite philosopher was Socrates, who we all know as the main character of all of Plato's dialogues. They both had the sort of same like wry sense of humor, wanted to sort of gadflies, wanted to, you know, go against, not go against society for its own sake, but because, you know, they both were really smart guys who were aware that the majority is misguided. Kierkegaard was, both Kierkegaard and Socrates were extremely spiritual people. The difference is, Kierkegaard recognized that you could never ever know what's up there. And he saw faith not as a, obviously a benefit, you know, obviously a great benefit to anyone, but as something that's exceptionally painful to I guess live with or live without, because it's the future is unknown, the only sure thing is death. And I mean, I know that sounds more like Sartre, but the Kierkegaard I think was at least the first philosopher I read, maybe the first philosopher ever, or at least Western philosopher. I'm sure a lot of the Chinese philosophers talked about this, but who really synthesized the emotional component of thinking, of philosophizing, with the intellectual component. And I'm sorry, so many of you know much more about this than me. Would anybody like to add anything on?
Kierkegaard takes sort of a position that, at least from the spiritual point, you can never know, you can only believe.
Sure.
And that's as good as it gets, and that's enough. That's sufficient. Mm-hmm. And if once you believe that, you can move on with your life and approach God or the afterlife more easily than you would.
More easily, but you can never really just let go. I mean,
well, you're not supposed to, but the point was, don't worry about it because you're never going to figure it out.
Right.
It's the same thing with ethics. Kierkegaard says, you know, ethics demands laws that are unbreakable.
Right.
To be a person of religious faith, you have to go beyond that because of guidelines. Abraham was told to kill his son, and it was precisely because of his obedience to kill his son that he's called the father of faith. And so that's the leap in the religious state of mind here, where ethical universals have to be broken over in order to.
Whereas most people think that was the most irrational thing.
Would you call him an anti-rationalist? I mean,
father of absurdity. Yeah. Imagine Sarah when he got home, he had to tell her all about that.
Not anti-rationalist, because he
slept on the couch.
Sure, oh, absolutely.
But to really be human, you had to go beyond that. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that that was bad, but what you were saying before, you have to go beyond certain things that are structured
right.
in order to
right.
flourish. And I think Kierkegaard is about flourishing as a committed Christian.
Mm-hmm.
It's only flourishing on that religious level.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank
not
you.
Not to over-problematize everything, but I mean, there's mid-century philosophy, so-called linguistic term philosophy, with Chomsky and, of course, Wittgenstein.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You can never go back.
Yeah, that's right.
Pre-Wittgenstein.
Yeah.
And to read Wittgenstein on how we use know and how we use belief and what counts as one or the other is such a dramatic, remarkable insight. So there's, as soon as we metaphorize anything or even start talking, we're already in the abstract. Of course, that's we can't get out of it.
I just randomly, just off the record, I just told somebody, another doctor, I said, I think Wittgenstein is the 21st century Kierkegaard, or 20th century Kierkegaard.
That's
I don't know
a
if
very
you buy
interesting.
That. Okay. Anyway, I'm going to skip this.
Logical Kierkegaard.
You have about 10 minutes.
Okay. I'll be fast through the rest of this. Okay, so I have a quote by Jerome Brunner that I like. I have never made a rational choice about the people I love and hate. Obviously, somebody said all this stuff before. In medicine, all humanist medicine, I think, live in the shadow of Viktor Frankl, who's a Holocaust survivor, who wrote the amazing book, Man's Search for Meaning, which I was unable to read again last year when I tried to pick it up. It is that horrifying to read about his accounts of the concentration camps. But his message is one of hope. It's that ultimately you can find hope in the flexibility of the self, the capacity to change oneself from within and transcend one's external constraints. And Frankl asserts that even the helpless victim of a hopeless situation facing a fate he cannot change may rise above himself, may grow beyond himself, and in doing so, and by doing so, change himself. And now for a case, and I'm going to pretty much end on this. So we saw a patient, this is when I was a med student, I saw a patient who was a 29-year-old guy with recurrent viral meningitis. And he had been on the service for a week or so with his family by his side, very ill, delirious. He got better, everybody was happy, patient goes home. He comes back 3 days later, and he looked different. He's anxious, he was pretty lucid, and he didn't seem as sick as before, but he said, "Doc, I need to get admitted. I still have these headaches, I still feel sick, I feel terrible, I'm throwing up," and so on and so forth. So he actually submitted himself to a lumbar puncture. He'd already had one when he was out of it. It's a lumbar puncture is a spinal tap. It's not the most fun thing to do. So we did a spinal tap, and it showed an increased white blood cell count. That is emblematic of a central nervous system infection. However, there were no organisms found in the fluid. It was just the increased white count. The infectious disease doctor said, "Look, this is probably just from," and I'm sorry, viral meningitis, you wouldn't see organisms anyway, but the white cell, they basically thought it was an artifact from the past hospitalization. But we were obligated to admit him. So this is the procedure he went through. Those of you who have given birth might have gone through something similar. So while this lab result was probably explained by the last episode, we were obligated to admit, all his blood work was normal, but the patient just was agitated and he kept asking for sedatives. We were giving him Ativan around the clock. He seemed unwell. I mean, he was truly suffering. We called in psychiatry finally. He had been in the hospital for a while, and when the psychiatrist left the room, so the patient was in there with the mother of his children. It turned out that the patient had cheated on his wife before the first episode of meningitis and was kicked out of the house after the second episode or something like that. And he had basically been like crashing on friends' couches, not eating. He was incredibly depressed, and he came back to the ER because he felt unwell. What do you think happened next? What did the doctors do next? I'm going to throw it out there.
Which doctors?
Discharge him.
Discharge him right away. Thank you. Of course. So the suffering experienced by this patient was not caused by any discrete etiology, and the residents following him were incensed. The junior resident confronted this patient about faking his illness, and he was promptly discharged from care. Yet I do not think that there was any conscious attempt on his end to mislead us. Unlike his physicians, and this is the key quote, the patient did not differentiate between the medically legitimate headache and weakness caused by meningitis from the illegitimate headache and weakness brought about by poor personal habits during a period of turmoil and uncertainty. While patients integrate their suffering, their emotional and physical suffering into a unified experience of illness, physicians treat somatic disease while overlooking emotional suffering. That's one of my favorite examples from my years in medical school. And here I have a quote to end this thing, or we're pretty much at the end. From Eric Cassell, as long as the mind-body dichotomy is accepted, suffering is either subjective and not truly real, not within medicine's domain, or identified exclusively with bodily pain. Not only is such an identification misleading and distorting, for it depersonalizes the sick patient, but it is itself a source of suffering. And I have dealt with enough angry families on psych consults and disgruntled patients to know that often we make things worse, and it's usually with the things we say more so than the things we do. Just to close, oops, wow, is that it? No, okay. I'm not gonna really get to touch on this stuff too much, but I think that existentialism and humanism are tied at the hip. You know what, let me skip ahead to, wow, is that it? I think I'm missing a couple slides. Anyway, So a couple questions that I thought of just since starting my internship, which is, you know, sometimes I'm on the floors writing up a history and physical, and I hear somebody screaming behind me, "Help, help, nurse, help." And to be a doctor, you have to train yourself to ignore that. And so, I want to treat all suffering is equal, but I'm sitting there totally ignoring a patient in a, let's say, an ER room, like right behind me, who is obviously in some sort of distress, and that's necessary to learn to be a doctor or just to get through. I don't think it's a good thing, but it's a real issue, and you have to desensitize your. I still get freaked out when they put in an extra an EJ line, like I. Blood, I'm not a fan of. So you know, I really respect people who can do that stuff. But I think part of what keeps me in touch with the humanistic side of medicine is that I don't really want to touch patients. Not just because, well, I wouldn't want them touching me. I mean, no, not, you know, I just, it's just it's an interpersonal thing. So I think doctors should just, you know, as to close, I think doctors should just take into account what patients have to subject themselves to every single day. And we're only with them for a few minutes a day, but they go through a lot behind the scenes in terms of blood draws and blood pressure checks, and it's a frustrating experience. And so finally, I'd like to just end on a goal and this whole existentialism thing. Like, my goal would be for doctors to see patients as similar to themselves and to recognize that the suffering that they experience is the same as the suffering their patients experience, or at least it's equally worthy. So that's it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Questions?
I think it'd be an interesting exercise to take all this philosophy and apply it to a group of extremely talented, well-paid mechanics. I mean, not that doctors are just body mechanics, but there's an analogy there.
Sure.
And again, talented, highly paid people working on really good cars.
It doesn't seem like they would know what to do with it, does it?
Well, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance.
Yeah, well.
But I'm saying that these are people who care about the vehicles. They want them to run and race,
mm-hmm.
or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And vehicles talk to people who are good mechanics, know by the sound of the car that certain things are wrong. So it'd be just interesting to see where the human emotional aspect of the patient and the doctor comes into play, because you would have with the mechanic.
Well,
we get a lot.
I don't know if car mechanics get training in how to deal with clients. I'm sure they get some. We get a lot of that stuff. It just doesn't stick for some reason. And unfortunately, I'm here preaching to the choir. I wonder how well this talk would have gone in a group of doctors. I still don't know, and hopefully someday I'll find out, but not as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, it depends on what doctors you're talking about. Surgeons?
That's true. Surgeons versus psychiatrists is a good...
Yeah, I mean, internal medicine people, family medicine people.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of 50-50, huh? Yeah.
I think another complicating issue is the thing is concepts of disease. You know, we think of concepts of disease. Notice they use the word malady, which is good because it doesn't stress whether it's a disease or something.
Or an illness,
An illness. But the fact is that a lot of disease concepts are culturally conditioned, created. And, you know, if you're thinking everything you're doing is objective, you're going to miss it.
Oh, yeah.
And I
wrote a really angry paper for Nora about how people say I am culturally competent as if it is a tangible quality that one can possess. That really bothers me, because I think that doctors take a couple courses here and there and feel like they know that Japanese people just don't want to be told that they have cancer. Okay, great. Now what about Cambodian people? You know nothing. You know, so it's frustrating to me. Yeah, sure.
I wonder how well would it do in terms of in medicine and hospitals with looking at, for example, the behavioral health movement, the recovery movement,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
Sort of having hospitals more integrated into the community in some way, I don't know, like
mm-hmm.
having more outreach and more...
You're speaking my language right now because I'm very interested in mental health care and how
right.
the severely ill diffuse into the community.
Right.
But... there's not a whole lot of doctors on board for the that movement yet, so let's leave it at that for now.
Well, in this country.
Yeah, that's true.
In
that's
Europe,
true.
I mean, they have a nicely integrated system in most countries.
I imagine that has something to do with the general healthcare system, more so than
also has to do with their underlying philosophy.
You think so?
Absolutely. They're
of what it means to be a doctor, what the doctor relationship is to the community,
sure. They're definitely more communitarian than we are. We're rugged individuals.
Yeah, that's right.
Elitist,
bullshit.
Rugged individuals.
That's right, which is bullshit in my opinion.
Okay, for someone who's applying to med school right now, I've heard a lot of schools are looking at, have a lot of complaints about doctors not caring about the humanistic side of medicine, and like as a religion major and someone who studied
sure.
philosophy and everything, you know, a lot of my secondary applications have been about how that really matters to me, and a lot of the questions about what have you done to understand the humanistic side of medicine and people different than yourself and stuff like that. But do you think that they really actually care about
No, I think that's a great question, and I think that here's the issue with it. We get I got a lot of evals saying that I was pretty empathetic. I think I'm extremely empathetic with my patients, but no one ever saw me with a patient. It is remarkably easy to fake for a doctor, for interviews, for a CV, humanism.
Yeah.
It is very hard to apply it. It's not very hard, but some people do it, some people don't, and unfortunately the people who do are probably going to be the people who are going to keep doing it and studying it and so on. And the people who ignore it and always ignore it are the ones who, you know, write, so I volunteered here and did this. But it's, you know, somebody checked their essay too, and that person, yeah. So there's no way to tell, but you know what, just actually caring will make a difference just for you and for your patients, so yeah. No questions?
Well, I don't know why you just don't use the term existential humanism.
Just
why,
use
why
it as one as one term?
Well, there is something, existential humanism. Humanism is one of the most problematic terms, you know, in the last century. It's just, you know,
not as problematic
from all the way from Paul Elmer Moore, the beginning, and Whitehead, all those folks.
Not as problematic as post-humanism.
Well, post anything, post or
post-humanism. I'm kidding, but sure.
You know, yeah, it's like a lot of people are going to immediately hearing humanistic or humanism have such biases, and that they're either embrace you or push you away.
That's right.
It's again because it's such a soft category, the term. It's problematic to some of these big conservative.
I think my main goal would be to make this soft stuff hard for doctors. Make it seem hard. And I don't know how I can do that.
So
yet.
I have some thoughts on that. And actually, so I actually directed an internship in humanism for like second, third year med students.
Yeah.
And the commissioner of health in New Jersey was like, we want to measure humanism. Let's come up. And I was like, I'm a philosopher. So I was like, are you really sure that you know that by measuring it, you therefore change what you're going to be measuring? And he was like, no, we have to have a publication, we have to show, we have to do this, that, and we have to have an evaluation.
Mm-hmm.
So making it hard, I'd actually like to see making it hard, but then letting people know that there really is no hardness to this at all.
Oh, absolutely, but that's the idea, is that if I could get every second-year med student to read, not Kierkegaard, but somebody's intro to Kierkegaard, I think that we'd have better doctors.
Or read poetry?
And, yeah, poetry. I mean, that's the thing, is that the way I see it, narrative medicine, medical anthropology, medical sociology, and it's all under this amorphous category of humanism and medicine, and I really think that existentialism deserves a piece of the pie, too, because it has a lot of unique insights that that are pretty much, you know, they basically they're kind of universal. They don't apply just to medicine, and I would like doctors to be a little more omnivorous, getting stuff from everywhere and not just from the New England Journal of Medicine. Like, let's put it that way. So, anyway.
All right, well, it's been quite a pleasure having you on that side of the table.
Yeah. I was over there talking about 5 minutes for like a whole semester.
So thank you very much.
Sure, thanks, Noah. Thanks, everyone. Wow.